Dr. Collins, the 20th century has had many names, the age of anxiety and so on and so on. One of the things that strikes me is the age of alienation, and it seems to me that even in the church, many of us in the church are in isolated nuclear units or in split families or isolated individuals. And we're hearing about the family, and it makes me wonder about Scripture, because Scripture or Revelation was given within the context of the extended family.
That's true.
And it seems there's almost a need for a rewrite of the of theology to meet the splintered society of today. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, what do you see as the needs of the church in an age of hurting people who, even with, say, home fellowship groups and all of the things that the church is structuring to meet those needs, that still there are many people across a whole spate of churches that have used these techniques for some time, are not seeming to resolve the deep alienation that people suffer. I hope I haven't overstated my case,
no,
but I do believe there's some truth in it.
Oh, I think you're right. I think there is a lot of alienation, but I think we have to recognize that the family, I'm glad you said, I thought you were going to say we need to rewrite the Bible. I'm glad you said we need to rewrite the theology. I think we need to recognize that a lot of what we've written about the family, we assume that it's kind of, you know, the mother who's the homemaker, the father who goes off to work, and the 2.4 children or whatever the percentage is, and the family dog. And we recognize that most families are not like that. Now, I know you, I think you take a census, what, every 5 years in Australia? We take a census every 10 years. And it's very interesting to look at the census data. And the last census that was taken just in 1990, I understand that you're about to do one now, we're doing one about this time. At home, that traditional family comprises, I think, 10 or 11% of the living units in the country. Only 10 or 11. Because if you start looking at families at home, you discover that they're very diverse. You have single-parent families. There are a lot of those. You have families where one of the parents is absent. You have families where a husband and wife are both involved in parenting, even though they no longer live together and may no longer be married to one another. We came across from Perth to I guess we're going to Adelaide the other day. The little girl on the plane. She was just a little tiny thing. And I asked her, where she been? She said, oh, I've been to see my daddy. And she said, I'm going back home to my mom. And here's a little girl with parents in different parts of the country traveling back and forth. That's a different kind of family unit. Then you have blended families where two people come together and marry, and they each bring their kids with them. And the blend doesn't always work out as well as you might think. Or you have families that are composed of, well, basically a couple that's living together after their children are gone. That's a different kind of family. You may have families of several adults. So it's interesting article appeared at home on one of our news magazines about 6 months ago. And it has a woman, probably about in her 40s, with her mother, who is obviously an older lady. And it says the average American woman will spend 17 years caring for her children and 18.5 years caring for her elderly parents. Isn't that interesting? So you may have families then that have older relatives living with you. Now, basically what we're saying is the family is a diverse unit in our society, and it's constantly changing, and we must recognize that. And if we don't take into consideration these different types of families, then I think we're really missing a marvelous opportunity for ministry. And I think we've got to be aware of that as we reach out to people around. Somebody just asked me, what about the ministry to singles? What about two single people that live together or four single people that live together? They live together as a family. And they may not plan to live together permanently in that kind of a relationship, but basically they're living together. It's less expensive. They've got companionship. And they live together in that kind of a relationship. How many people live with members of the opposite sex and they're not married? And we might not think of that as a family, but the Census Bureau considers that a family unit. What about two people of the same sex that live together and in a homosexual relationship? Now, we struggle with that because of what the Scriptures teach about homosexuality. But the Census Bureau considers that a family unit. And I think we need to be aware of this diversity, aware of this really fractionization of the family, if there's such a word. But your comment about the extended family and the Scriptures talking about that, I think that's right. When I was in Bombay several years ago, and I had an interesting lunch one day with a man who said, "I hope that our family counseling doesn't become like your family counseling." Because he said, "You talk about a husband and wife and their kids, and that's what you think of as a family. Or you work with individuals one-on-one. But here, we have the extended family where the aunts and the uncles and the cousins and the grandparents are all involved. And you don't counsel with one member, you deal with the entire family." You see some of that in some of the Oriental cultures. And we need to be aware of that. It changes our whole perspective on family counseling. Lord willing, tomorrow I want to talk about some of the ways that we can radically change our ways of looking at counseling. One of those ways is we may find that we're going to be doing less and less one-on-one counseling. And we're going to have to be dealing with broader groups of people, maybe a whole family unit. And that's going to be very difficult. Maybe a family unit that is from another country. I read an article not long ago called The Asianization of Australia. You know what that's about? How do you relate to the Asian families in your midst and the challenges that they bring and the different perspectives that they bring? All of these are crucial issues, and I think we've got to keep that in mind as we deal with the family and recognize that the family is broader than just what we've considered on a traditional basis. And I think you're right. If the church doesn't deal with that, we're going to miss the families, because most families in our society are not the traditional kinds of families that we think about. I hope there was more comment I think you made, and hope I answered what you were thinking about. Because I think it's
just add one thing. Leave that up, Peter, if we'd... Just one thing about the wizard was saying, what should churches be doing in that sort of area? I mean, we recognise, say, the problem,
yeah.
But the challenge is then to move beyond the problem recognition to doing something about it.
It's easier to recognise the problem.
Sure. Okay, well, that's the end of that. Next question.
Okay, let's take the next question. Yes, you do
a
fine
great
job.
Courage here.
Yeah, and we want to have you. I want to compliment you on your creativity. Okay. I suppose we've got to be sensitive to the needs of people. Maybe that's a good place to start. And here again, I think if the church is meeting needs, people are going to come. It's interesting to me that if you talk about you talk about parenting, people will come to something on parenting. And maybe you need to think more about seminars. Look at the seminar that Jill and Stuart Briscoe are going to do, for example. They're doing a seminar on families. Now a seminar can be very threatening, and some people don't want to come. So then you go back to the kinds of things I mentioned this morning, where you maybe have a meeting for men, where you bring some kind of a sports figure in. You need to think of how we can meet the needs of different members of the family, and it may be we need to have a different kind of music. We may need to have different kind of format in our church services. We maybe even need to have different times in our church services. I'm told that many of the church services were held at 11 o'clock in the early days because the farmers would go out, do their work in the morning, and come home at 11 o'clock. One of the churches in our area has services on 9 o'clock Sunday morning, 11 o'clock Sunday morning, and 6 o'clock Saturday night. You know why they have them on Saturday night? Because they reach a lot of yuppies who are not accustomed to going to church and don't like the idea of getting up and going to church in the morning. So we'll have a meeting Saturday night. And a lot of those are people who never thought of going to church. They're used to going up to the bars on Saturday night. So we have church before they go to the bars. And ultimately, they go to church and they don't go to the bars. But it's a time when you hold the service. Maybe we've got to think about that. Maybe even where we have the services. So I think that kind of creativity. Go around the circle I had on the board today. Maybe think about some preventive things. Think about some things that you can say when you speak to people in that public way. Think about some of the needs people have and creative ways to deal with them. I think here's a place where we've got to take counseling and move it beyond one-on-one sitting in an office. I'm going to push on that tomorrow if I can a little bit. Not push, I don't want to give the wrong impression. But when we talk about the trends that are taking place and where I think we're going, that I think is one of the trends. We've got to think of more innovative ways to break out of the little counseling box, the way we've looked at counseling, and think in people helping in its broadest perspective. It's a big question. I'm sorry I don't have a better answer. You know, this lady down there had her hand up. I thought, were you just stretching? Just stretching. Well, good. I'm waving. Nice to see you. Thank you. Anybody else want to wave? Okay, seriously, yes, sir, you've got a question. Can you just get to that nearby microphone? Thank you.
My question was going to be on your last comment, actually, about restructuring approaches to counselling, yes. Moving beyond one person after another and so mm-hmm. on. Mm-hmm. Verse of scripture that comes to me about the whole approach of teaching is in Deuteronomy 6, I think it is, where it says that you will teach your children when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. It's a much more natural way of teaching than in a more formal setting.
Right.
And we are very formalised in a kind of the kinds of settings we're familiar with classes or clients and that kind of thing. So I would really like to hear a little bit more, because I may not be here tomorrow and others may not be, to hear what are the trends in restructuring.
Yeah.
I've already made my own decisions about that.
Yeah.
And have a much more longer approach and a more holistic approach to bringing people under influence of teaching and counselling, which is not necessarily in a clinical sense. So your comments on that, on what are the innovations?
I'd like to say I don't want to jump too far ahead tomorrow, but just make a couple of comments if I can at this point. I think that I don't want in any way to put down the clinical approach. I don't want to in any way criticize that one-on-one approach in offices, because I think that needs to be done and it will always need to be done. And if you are involved in that, that's a significant part of your helping ministry. However, I think we probably need to move more into what a couple of people have raised, more of an educational model. And I think we're seeing that in the field. And by an educational model, that just doesn't mean teaching. You teach people in a variety of ways. You can teach them in this way, but this is a relatively inefficient way. You're much better to teach people by giving them experiences, by giving them modeling, by being examples to people, by letting them see what a family is like. Somebody has suggested in a book that I read recently that what we have to do as a church is prove to the society around us that marriages can survive and grow for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. We have to model that. We have to demonstrate that. With our own kids, if you sit your kids down to tell them something, you don't get very far, do you? But if you kind of are aware of your children, let them model things. Our own kids are now at the age where they said to us, Mom and Dad, we've seen you. We've seen you do some things. We've watched how you communicate. We've learned just by the way you've lived your lives. And that's pretty sobering to think about. And people see us as we go about our business, as we go about our activities, and as we're sensitive to people who are around, and ask the Lord to give us that psychological moment, the right teaching moment. And often we can have a great deal of influence. I think a lot of counseling comes on the way to basketball games, sitting in coffee shops, interacting with people as you drive off someplace together. And sometimes that's where the best counseling comes, sitting around the fireplace at night, times when you least expect it, and up comes something. You're riding in a car someplace and you get talking about something, and a marvelous opportunity to share arises. Sometimes that comes when you least expect it, or you least are prepared for it, or you least want it. But I think when we're open to those kinds of situations, then I think we're going to see ourselves be more effective in counseling. But I think we need what some people have called a paradigm shift, and we'll talk a little bit about that, Lord willing, tomorrow. Let's take maybe one more, and then let me do two or three of these questions relatively briefly. And these are good questions. Yes, go ahead. Thank you.
Do you find it a waste of time to counsel people that aren't ready for actual change? Do you sort of like put them off and then counsel those that are ready for change?
That's a good question, because I think we have to recognize that many people are not ready for change. And they maybe even come for counseling, but they don't want to change. Now, there's reasons for this. Change is threatening. And sometimes people would prefer to stay with the problem, miserable as it is, and to pack up and bring about a change. It's easier to be depressed, because at least you know what that's like, than to be undepressed and have to face the realities of a world in which you're undepressed. I think there is a time, if you work with a person for a few times and they're not making any kinds of improvement, a time of backing off, and maybe say, look, I recognize, okay, I don't want to push you into this. Maybe you're not ready yet. Why don't you back off a little bit, and we'll come back to you a little bit later. You're not criticizing them, you're not putting them down, but you are spending your time more with people who are more open to change. By the same token, be careful you don't reject people in those cases, because some of those people are testing you. Is this person really going to stick with me when things are difficult? And if they know, I still want to stick with you, I still care about you, I'm still concerned about you, but maybe we're not making a lot of progress. That sometimes motivates them to get moving if they see you're going to back off. But sometimes it's better for you to back off like Jesus did and go where there are other needy people. And that's a judgment call. And sometimes other believers can help you on that. Well, the questions are good, but they're getting more and more of them. Let me deal with a couple of these very briefly. This question was not written by my wife. I want to assure you of this. Which of your books would you recommend for people who are professionally trained? It may be valuable, and we thought about this, at least I thought about this, Julie and I talked about this, maybe to prepare a list of books sometime that we could get to you later, I shouldn't say this without checking with the committee, of some of the things that might be books both that I've written and that other people have written that could be helpful. In terms of those of you who are professional, I did a book once called Innovative Approaches to Counseling, in which I try at that point to talk about non-traditional ways of counseling. And talk about lay counseling, talk about preventive counseling, talk about environmental counseling, changing the environment out there, which is an effective way to counsel sometimes. Just putting people in a different environment can have a powerful impact. That's one book. You've seen the Christian counseling book. Some of you have heard, you know about the Can You Trust counseling book. I wrote a book several years ago that I don't even know if it's still available. It's still in print, but called Can You Trust Psychology? Called The Rebuilding of Psychology. In that book, I try to argue that psychology needs to be rebuilt on a biblical foundation. And it's a book on the integration of psychology and Christianity, written about 12 or 13 years ago. It probably needs to be updated and revised. But that might be a kind of book that if you're interested in integration, that might be helpful. Now, in terms of those of you who are not professionals, many of you have seen the Little People Helper book that I wrote. I'm revising that right now. And I'm about half the way through, and I hope later on this year I'll get that book revised. It's sometimes harder to revise a book than it is to write it, but I think it needs to be updated and brought into a little more contemporary cover design and basically rewritten. The most recent book that I've done is not out yet. I don't even know who's going to publish it. That's being worked on while I'm away. It's a book on how to be a difference maker. I took 10 weeks last summer at the urging of my wife and a couple of other people, and I just withdrew, and I wrote this book because it was something I wanted to do. And it was a book about people who are making a difference. Not big-name people who are making a difference. Billy Graham makes a difference. Jim Dobson makes a difference. Political figures make a difference. But what about the little people? What triggered my thought was my 84-year-old mother, who said, "I'm not useful to anybody. I can't make any difference. All I can do is just pray." I said, "Hey, Mother, you're making a difference." We called her the other day from Perth. I said, "I hate to remind you about this, but we're probably further away from you now than we'll ever be in our whole lives. But let me tell you, we can be there in 24 hours if any kind of emergency comes along." She's a little nervous about us being so far away. She said, "Well, I've been praying for you." And I said, "Keep that up. But what about people who feel they don't have the training, they don't have the expertise, they don't have the opportunities? How can they be difference makers?" I am convinced, as a result of doing research for this book and reading the scriptures about this, that we can all be difference makers, and that's exciting to think about. Well, maybe that's a good way to finish. We'll find a time to work in these other questions tomorrow. But it seems to me that what this is all about is to be a difference maker. And we come from different perspectives. I have watched some of you stifling yawns in the last half hour, and I can understand that. And that's no reflection on the speaker. That's a reflection on a long, warm day, and you've been with us all that time. Your adrenaline maybe has been pumping, but the adrenaline is slowing down, and hopefully you can slow down also. This, from my perspective, has been a wonderful day. It's been a marvelous time together. And I look forward to another day like this tomorrow. I'm grateful for the way the Lord has been leading and will continue to lead. And I hope you have a good night. Now, don't walk out yet, because our chairman surely has concluding words of wisdom to send us on our way. You're on.
If you have any other questions that you'd like to write out, please write them out and pop them in here, because we won't be accepting any questions that are not in here after lunch. Just one question, Gary, and that's in relation to the issue of some of us are involved in equipping lay people helpers. Could you just make a couple of observations in terms of effective strategies in doing that?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Appreciate you're raising that, because I think that's a significant issue. I mentioned yesterday a book by Sin Yang Tan, and Sin Yang, in writing this book, he's looked into the literature on lay counseling, and there's a tremendous amount of literature on this. T-S-I-A-N, I don't know. The last name is Tan, T-A-N.
No, that's not right.
No, it's Sin Yang. Have I got it there? T-S-I-N-G-Y-A-N-G, I think.
The book is available.
Okay, good. It's three. Do we want one? Anyhow, his last name is Tan. I think it's S-I-N-G-Y-A-N-G. I may have left the letter out. But Sin Yang. That's right. That's Y-A-N. Y-A-N in the middle. Sin Yang Tan. Anyhow, the last name is Tan. It's published by Zondervan Publishing House. And I think if you go in and ask for the book by Dr. Tan, published by Zondervan Publishing House, Sin Yang Tan, nice try. I think it's S-I-A-N-G-Y-A-N-G. The name of the book, I think, is Lay Counseling. Now, in this book, Dr. Tan looks into the question that Peter just raised, and how you train lay counselors. Now, one of the struggles that I've had since I've been here, maybe I should clarify that a little bit. One of the struggles that I've had since I've been here is to ask the question, to what extent do we deal with issues on more techniques, and to what extent do we deal with issues that are more direction, where are we kind of going? Now, I think most of the sessions that I've been asked to do, and I really appreciate the outlines, most of the sessions have really been talking about this very question that was just raised. How do we equip people? How do we train people? How do we move in that direction? But in this one session that we just had, I took a little different approach and talked more about some techniques and more of the kinds of things we've done, or we do in counseling, so we can focus on that. Now, in terms of setting up a lay counseling program, as I mentioned yesterday, you have to be concerned about several things. You have to be concerned about selection. Now, there are all kinds of theories on selection. Tan talks about that in his book. Do you let everybody come, or do you choose carefully on this with some people? I wrote an article about this. I may have a copy with me that probably I could leave and have it duplicated. But it's wrote several years ago in Leadership Magazine. You need to be a little careful who you select. Then you need to come up with a training program. Now, there are training programs that exist out there. The People Helper program is one, but that's a program that I developed several years ago. There are other programs that are more recent. Some churches I know use Corey's book but Corey's book is strictly secular and has no real Gerard Egan, E-G-A-N. But he's got a very good approach on training people in people helping skills. So you've got to think about what kinds of information do you need to go into that. And many times you need to sit down and work that out, I think, yourself, especially with people around you who can help, but also with some of these people who have written about this. And there is research that has been accumulated on what training techniques you use. Then the third question you have to ask is, how are you going to use the people after they're trained? Where are they going to be placed, and how are we going to use them? Who is going to supervise them if somebody supervises them? And I think that probably should be done. Do they know how to make referrals? That's one of the things that they are going to be taught along the way. So I think the question of selection, training, and utilization are the three major topics. And there are a group of theories, I suppose, that have been written in this area. Now, it is difficult. This is one of those questions I've had several, but it's difficult to summarize in just a few paragraphs, obviously. I think Tan's book will help. There's another book came out on peer counseling by Bear, B-E-A-R, and Stuckey, S-T-U-C-K-I. Bear and Stuckey. It may be the other way around. It may be Stuckey and Bear, but it's called peer counseling. That approach, these are two people, one is a pastor and one is a psychiatric social worker. These two people have written a book in which they describe how they have set up peer counseling, and they refer to a number of churches who have peer counseling programs, and they summarize the peer counseling programs in these churches. That book, the Tan book, is published by Zondervan. The Stuckey and Bear book is published by Word. I know of another man who is now beginning work on a third book in this area who feels that these first two books have not really dealt with it in a way that it should be, that is as clear as it should be in terms of how it's been developed.
I think we're on the verge of something that is developing as a new approach, and I think these people, these other people you can draw on, I'll bring in that article this afternoon, and you can have a look at that. But then I think maybe you need to have a look at where you are, the kinds of people you deal with, and build programs that draw on these other ones that have been established. But build programs that are adaptable to the culture. I've asked a couple of times while I've been here, how do you take some of these counseling principles to maybe third world cultures, or maybe places where they don't have very much counselor training? Well, here again, you have to understand the people that you're trying to reach, have to understand the culture, it becomes very important, and then see, okay, what are the needs in that culture? How do they perceive people helping in that culture? And you might recognize that a training program that would work fine in one part of the United States might not work fine in another part. And certainly wouldn't work in Honduras, and may be very different than what would happen in Queensland, and that again may be different than what would happen in India. So I think we need to recognize that we need a little bit aware of what's going on. If you can figure out how to spell a man's name, I think Tan's book will help you, the Stuckey and Bear book will help you. Those are, because they at least give you some principles of the things you ought to be considering. The Tan book, incidentally, is more technical than the Stuckey and Bear book.
Well, we'll try to get hold of some of those for here this afternoon.
And I think if some of those can be available, that can be helpful. Otherwise, we can work on some ways to get them. I have a lot of questions, and I want to make sure we get these questions dealt with while we're here. But I also want to be sensitive to the time and sensitive if anybody has a question that's really pressing coming out of this morning. Otherwise, I would think, Peter, take one or two like this, and then I think we maybe go to these questions that people handed in.
Just a short one. You mentioned Paul Tournier.
Yes.
Two things. I know you highly respect him, and others do too. You also talk about, I guess, modern, up-to-date things. How do you feel people have got his books, the value of them still today, still quite relevant for present-day counseling?
Well, he's relevant? Okay. Yeah. Paul Tournier, thank you. That's a good question. Paul Tournier, he died 2 or 3 years ago, so, of course, he's not, and he stopped writing several years before that. He was in his 90s when he died, and I think that towards the end he wasn't writing as much as he did before. Tournier is still helpful. Tournier is a man whose books are filled with insights, but Tournier's books are very difficult to read because he rambles all over the place, and that's very hard for me. He'll say, I want to give you 3 points on something, and then he said the first is this, and then you can never find the second and the third because he kind of forgot about that. And his writing style, he told me, was such that he said, that's all right. I've had a friend who talked to him one day, and he said, look, on this page of the book you say this, and 10 pages over you contradict yourself. And he said, oh yeah, that's probably true, but I was talking about a different topic 10 pages over. See, that kind of thing drives an academic person crazy, and drives most of the rest of us. It's very difficult to handle that. So I think Tournier's books, there is insight in there, but Tournier's books are not as helpful now, I think, as they were several years ago. But I look at him as a pioneer who did something in work in bringing together some theological things and some psychological things. Now, some of you will be distressed with Tournier's theology. I was. Tournier was a universalist. He believed that everybody will ultimately be saved. And that was a problem with me. But he didn't like to talk about theology. And I began to look at, well, if his theology, I can say his theology is not correct because it's not like mine. But what about this? And I began to look and recognize there are people, God uses people who have different theologies. And that's a sobering thing to think about, isn't it? And it may be when we get to heaven that all of us may have some problems with our theology. I doubt that with mine, but isn't this true, though? We're in this room. We come from different backgrounds. We have different perspectives on some things. And yet God uses us. And we don't have to have a perfect theology or a perfect psychology to be used. And God used Tony, I think, in some significant ways. Okay, maybe now other people have taken over. And that's all right. I think that's probably going to be true of all of us. 100 years from now, maybe nobody will have heard of us. But other people will take over and maybe have learned from us and grown beyond where we are. And that's exciting. And that's the way the Lord works. Excellent question. But that's, I think, where we are with Tony. Now, let me hit some of these questions here. Somebody did raise a question about Maslow while we're talking about individuals. Maslow is the man. Who is Maslow, and what is your opinion of his theories? It kind of comes off of this one here. Maslow was a man who was president of the American Psychological Association for some time. He was the man who was a man who was very much interested in humanistic psychology, and he was humanistic in his orientation. But he was also very interested in religious experience and in peak experiences. And many people would say that he was a lot of the basis of humanistic psychology. He was kind of the father of this, just like Freud was the father of psychoanalysis. Maslow was the father of humanistic psychotherapy, and he was the person that had this hierarchy that you may be familiar with, a hierarchy of needs. Once you got your biological needs met, then you came into getting needs of love and that kind of thing. At the top was your need for self-actualization, and few people got there. I have found Maslow to be stimulating in several respects. One way, for example, he spent a lot of time originally writing books about abnormality and people who had problems. And he began to think, you know, we learn from those people, but maybe we ought to start looking at people who are psychologically healthy. And so he started to look for people who were psychologically healthy. He couldn't find too many, but he found some, and on the basis of that, he built his theory. That's what Nick Stanay was doing with his study of healthy families that I mentioned last night. And I think if we're going to be Christian counselors, if we're going to be training people in lay counseling, let's look at different writers. But let's look at not only what causes problems and how we deal with problems, let's also look at what brings about healthy Christianity and healthy marriages and healthy relationships and healthy careers and healthy families to stimulate that. That's two sides of the same coin, but we sometimes have a strong pathology-type model instead of a health-type model. And I kind of like Maslow's emphasis in that respect. But what do I think of his theories? I'd just be a little cautious of some of his writings. He died, I think, in 1961, so he doesn't have the influence he did before. But be cautious because of his strong humanistic orientation. Now, two people raised questions about another writer, Scott Peck. What are your thoughts about Dr. Scott Peck, who wrote The Road Less Traveled and People of the Lie? Is he secular, New Age, or Christian? And another question, is Scott Peck, author of People of the Lie and The Road Less Traveled, influenced by New Age thinking? Do you think his books are generally helpful? I was talking about a friend one time was telling me he went into a bookstore and asked if they could get a copy of a Gary Collins book. And somebody said, oh, no, we only carry Christian books in this bookstore. And somebody said, well, Gary Collins is a Christian. Well, the lady said, well, let me go back and see if I can get a copy of, if we can order a copy of this, because, you know, we're very careful of the books we had in our bookstore. So the lady went out the back to check with the manager to see whether she could order a copy of Gary Collins' books. And my friend was standing in the bookstore, and there on the counter were books on reality therapy, transactional analysis, I'm okay, you're okay, and books by Scott Peck. Well, Scott Peck, is a questionable individual, and it's a good question. Where is he? In Melbourne one night, after we had a meeting at the Congress, he went down to the university district for some coffee, a little coffee shop, pulled up the car, got out of the car, and we were right next to a New Age bookstore. I knew it was a New Age bookstore because it said so, and it had a whole bunch of crystals in the window, and a lot of New Age things in there, and right in the window was a big display of Scott Peck's books. Now, it's my understanding that Dr. Peck, when he wrote the first book, The Road Less Traveled, was not a believer, but was close to it. When he wrote his second book, The People of the Lie, in which he talks a lot about satanic things, apparently he had become a believer between the first and the second book, I am told. But still, he was a new believer. When you get to the third book, he's got a third book called A Different Drummer. And you read the third book, and his New Age influence has come out very clearly in the third book. And if you read The Different Drummer, which he says is a third of the three books he's going to write, and he decided he wasn't going to write anymore, and he may not stick with that. But at one point in that third book, he talks about the fact that we are all one with each other, we're all one with nature, we're all one with the furniture around us. You know, that kind of a unity of what it's not a pantheism, is it? But it's kind of that kind of thinking comes out in his book. And because somebody referred to the third book as Scott Peck's New Age book, and so I was alerted to look for it. And as I looked for it, it became very clear to me that there were some strong New Age influences there. Scott Peck is a very insightful writer. I would encourage you to read his books. I think you could learn some things from it, but just be cautious, because here is somebody who probably, at least if he is a Christian, he's not a very mature Christian, and that's not to criticize anybody. But if we want to learn from people who are going to help us to be stimulating other people in their spiritual growth, we don't look to people who are babes in Christ so far and haven't learned to really feast on the real meat, but are still taking part of the milk of the Word. I don't know where Scott Peck is today. I've never met the man. I've not heard him speak, but I have a little bit of caution about what he's saying. But it's interesting that a man like that stimulates the whole profession to think about evil. And to think about the satanic and about the demonic, a question that's not come up at all during our time here together. And yet I think something we have to think very seriously about. Now, the rest of these are not particularly in any real order. So I'm not. I've shifted them back and forth. So please don't think I'm reading them and giving them any specific order of importance. Could you discuss mental illness? Good question. What are the causes, organic and the demonic? Is there hope for the schizophrenic? Or is long-term medication a necessity? What about voices that people hear? Where are the Christian counseling courses in Queensland and preferably in central Queensland? I think that second question might be a different question. Okay, the whole question of mental illness obviously is a complex one. And I would suggest simply this. We recognize that I'd be careful if anybody comes along with one cause. If anybody says all mental illness comes about because of biology, because of the sin in the person's life, because of a demonic involvement, because of interpersonal tensions in the society, watch out for that. Because I suspect that each person who has a severe psychological disorder has a complex of causes. I usually think that the causes come from the environment and or from within. Sometimes it's inner turmoil that brings about the problem, or it's environmental stress. The problems can be biological, and this is a good question about this. Many of the problems, schizophrenia, for example, has a strong biological element. Many people suggest that most, if not all, schizophrenia has a biological cause. And if it doesn't have a biological cause, well, at least when a person develops this condition, there are biological changes that take place within the organism which require medical treatment. Depression has a strong biological cause, although I suspect there are some depressions which are clearly psychological, but I'd watch for that. Is there hope for the schizophrenic? Yes. There's evidence that given proper treatment, people can change. However, it depends on how long the schizophrenia has been around. If it's a chronic schizophrenia that's been around for 30, 40 years, it's a lot harder to treat and to see hope than if it's something that's come along on a relatively short period of time. That's true with any kind of an illness, psychological or physical illness. Sometimes the voices, that's a characteristic of people who have schizophrenic disorders. And when a person has these kinds, hears voices, thinks that the demons are chasing them, these kinds of things, does not think clearly, has some bizarre thinking, begins to think that people are watching you on television, that kind of thing, obviously that's bizarre behavior. I'd be very cautious. Don't try to deal with that. There's a place where you need those professionals, especially professionals who've got a lot of training in this issue and can help. Can they give help? Yes, they can give help. And this is something which I think is one of the things you should deal with in local counseling courses. And it's a place where you have people who are well qualified here in Queensland and other parts of Australia to deal with those issues. But they're very good questions, and I suspect they come out of the mind of somebody who probably has wondered about this. Is mental illness demonic? Well, I think the devil is behind all of our problems along the way in some place. I'm nervous about saying mental illness is the result of demons. I think the effect of Satan's forces probably are there someplace. But many times we can treat these things with good medication, with good counseling, good therapy. I think this can become helpful. I think it's especially helpful when you have medical treatment, you have psychological treatment, and you have involvement with whole families. So you're looking at the social circumstances in which the person comes, and then you deal with the spiritual elements. Those four become important: the biological, the psychological, the sociological, and the spiritual. I was talking to somebody the other day, I think it was in Perth, where they said, we have a hospital here, a psychiatric hospital, and they discourage counseling because they don't have a lot of people around, so they treat everybody medically, and that doesn't really help them a lot. Well, medication becomes important, but I think we need more than that. And here, if you find a good, competent professional, this can help. Long-term medication sometimes is necessary, but not always. Where is Christian counseling courses available in central Queensland? Quick, tell me. Pardon? Lifeline's got a course, right. Go ahead, Peter. Don't you guys have a course?
We have a course, and if they would like to invite Baptist Family Ministries up into central Queensland, we'll make arrangements.
Okay. So we call it the Baptist...
Family Ministries.
Baptist Family Ministries has a course. Lifeline has a course.
Anglican Family Care would be responsive, as I understand it, to some provision. They are working up the coast in terms of establishing networks there.
Now, what if somebody is in a remote part of Queensland? This person may be here. What if somebody is a long ways up the coast and you feel there's not much up there? Let me suggest that one of the things that I have heard rumblings about in the last few days here is a real concern about where do we go from here? That's exciting to think about. And I'm going to make some suggestions, I hope, tonight, and maybe where we might go from here, from this conference. One of the things I think we have to do is what the profession is doing.
That's this afternoon, Gary, isn't it?
I'll talk about future trends this afternoon and a little bit of that stuff tonight when we start talking about some of the social issues. But I want to focus on some of this stuff as we move from here. Yes, that's right. Thank you, Peter. Because I think if we could think about some creative ways for getting training to people who are in remote areas. Now, training by videotape, training by correspondence is not ideal. In fact, it's probably not even the best. But sometimes that can be something that supplements training that takes place in a more centralized area. And I think if you can think about some creative ways to do this, I think that even though the training now is more centralized in places like Perth and Adelaide and Victoria, down in Melbourne, maybe some in Sydney, places in Brisbane, maybe in Cairns, and I'm not sure about up there, but maybe centralized in some places like that, I think as you develop here and as you are developing, it's going to spread out. Now, our time is just about gone. Let me just hit the next one. You mentioned I've dealt with this a little bit. Physiological causes for depression. What would be indicators of this? How would you recognize the need for someone to have medical treatment as compared to perhaps cognitive therapy or someone who would need to have both? Let me suggest that if you are not a physician, it's hard for you to know whether a person needs medical treatment. And I would suggest that if in doubt, ask a physician to have a look at the individual. If you talk to somebody about a problem and they're depressed and they don't seem to be making much progress after a very short time, check out the physiology. And it may not be something that is, it may be something very minor. It may be something in their diet. There may be some kind of a glandular malfunctioning. It may be something strictly physiological that is contributing to the physical problem. Sometimes, of course, if the person's not getting enough rest, not getting enough exercise, those kinds of things, of course, we need to be dealing with. But I think that you need, all of us need to be willing to refer and to get a physical examination. I think one of the reasons you know there's something physical, if the person doesn't seem to be improving, comes for counseling, stays depressed. If you have something like a depression that you might guess would be hormonal, a person who is depressed, perhaps in connection with a menstrual cycle, the depression sometimes comes there. A postpartum depression comes after the birth of a child. A post-surgical depression, which may come about, because the body has somehow been disrupted or changed about in some way, and that would give you a good clue because of when the depression comes. Well, we have a number of other questions, and I'm going to try to allow a little more time, maybe this afternoon, so we can make sure we get these questions answered. So if I haven't come to your question yet, we will come to them. This afternoon, I hope you recognize that this afternoon when we talk about the future, and tonight when we talk about social issues, these are things that are as relevant, I would hope, and I hope they'll be as relevant to you as any of the issues we talked about to this point. Because I think it's exciting to ponder what's happening and where we're going and what can be done as you think about Christian counseling here and where you are and where you happen to work and live. Thanks again for your attendance and your attention. We'll talk again after lunch. Okay, let's see how far we can get. Somebody raised this challenge. I'm concerned about your comments about Scott Peck. He's a Catholic. In his book, What Return Can I Make?, a book that I'm not familiar with, he tries to respond to the question, God has done so much for me through the suffering and death of his son, what can I do for him? What return can I make? Peck writes that in that book about the grace of God, forgiveness, guilt, suffering, and sacrifice. He was outspoken about this concept of I'm okay, you're okay, because he said, some of us, none of us is okay, and we're all sinners saved only by the grace of God. If the books appear in a New Age bookstore, it doesn't mean the author is New Age. They include everybody, unfortunately. Let me respond to the last part. You're absolutely right. And I talked a couple of nights ago about being careful not to imply guilt by association. Maybe there's an example of my doing something that I said we shouldn't do. Just because somebody's got a book in a bookstore a New Age bookstore doesn't mean the book is New Age or the author is New Age. I appreciate what the person has said about this. And that's very interesting to me. I still maintain he's got some strong New Age elements in his book, A Different Drummer. And I think that is pretty clear. But I think, you know, maybe he's like all of us. Maybe he's grappling with some things and he's in the process of searching and that kind of thing. Some people I know wait until I get everything clear before they write their first book and then they're too old to write it. Other people are willing to write while they're in the process of developing ideas and maybe they change later as they go along. So I appreciate the person who has who has made this comment, because it helps us a little bit to get a clearer perspective on Scott Peck. Somebody else handed a question right at the beginning, and I haven't gotten to it yet. It's a little bit of a complex question, but I think it's a very important one. Granted, we need to have a heavenly identity. This is a question about self-esteem and dying to yourself. Granted, we need to have a heavenly identity and a realistically appreciated picture of ourselves. However, self-esteem appears to have steamrolled into the church. I think that's probably true. We have a lot of seminars, and everybody's concerned about self-esteem. Jesus commanded us to love others as we love ourselves, but he also commanded us to die to self. How can we reconcile these two apparently contradicting aspects as counselors? Could it be that the words in Christ, that he is in us and we in him, could that resolve the problem? What are the practical implications of this whole issue for our clients? Some of you, if you're really concerned about this, may want to get David Carlson's book in the series I edited. He's got a book on self-esteem, counseling and self-esteem. And David's done a marvelous job on this. And one of the things that I found most helpful, he says that to a large extent, we have difficulties because we don't define our terms carefully. We assume, for example, that if a person is going to deny oneself, that self-denial and self-condemnation are the same. They're not the same. And so we think that to deny ourselves, we've got to condemn ourselves. And I don't think that's the same thing. Or, for example, Dave Carlson says, we sometimes think that self-esteem is the same as self-promotion and pushing yourself. That's not true. You can have a good self-esteem and still be a very humble person. So maybe we've got to be very, very cautious about the terminology we use. And I think that happens, that permeates a lot of the debate here. Dave Carlson and Jay Adams had a debate on a local radio station at home on the whole issue of self-esteem. It was very interesting, the debate they had, because David said essentially what I said the other day. We can have a positive self-esteem because of what Christ has done in us and what he is doing in us, and we can maintain our humility in all of this. We can deny our own pushes to get ahead and to build ourselves. We can still deny ourselves and serve Christ effectively, but still have a positive self-esteem. And Jay Adams says, well, what are we here for? I don't have any problem with that. Having still written a whole book on condemning the whole idea of self-esteem. See, when we get our terminology correct, then I think there's not as much of a difficulty as we might think. However, some of the books that are written about self-esteem, books that are written in the secular world, talk about the fact that we can have high self-esteem because of the great people we are. And they're built on a humanistic view of human nature, which talks about human goodness and that kind of thing. That, I think, has to be modified by Christians in accordance with the Scripture, some of the ways we were talking about the other night. Now, somebody asked if I have a suggested list for people to fill out before counseling. I think several of these have been published, and you can find them in different books. The Tan book that we talked so much about has a list. The Bear and Stuckey book has a list. If you want a big long one, you can look, and there's a book on the book table on counseling people with sexual problems. That has a different kind of list. I think if you look into some of these books, you'll see that there are often forms that people can fill out just to give a little bit of background and that can help you to get information before you start talking to the person. Several people raise questions about the New Age movement. What dangers are there from the New Age movement and its influence on Christians who counsel and on Christians generally? And they give a couple of examples. For example, the reciting of a mantra. A mantra, as you know, is a word that you say over and over again to help you calm down. These mantras are assumed to be neutral words, but they're, for the most part, from my understanding, Hindu words. And a lot of what's going on in these kinds of situations is a Hindu form of worship. Some people came along at Harvard University and said, we will do some research, and instead of having a mantra, you just say the numbers, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. And they discovered people could calm down physiologically just as well by saying those numbers as they could by using this Hindu mantra. I'm very concerned about meditating, however, on a mantra or on a 1, 2, 1, 2, because the Scriptures tell us to meditate, but they tell us to meditate on the Word of God. And we read this in various parts of the Psalms especially, and I think we must be very careful not to be emptying our minds of things to the extent that therefore we let anything comes in that wants to pop in there. I think we focus our attention on the Word of God, and that becomes very important. So, well, this person says, well, what about intense marathon sessions? I wonder how much they really accomplish. Sometimes, and there's debate about this, sometimes they're designed to wear people down, but sometimes I think they become almost cruel, especially some of these, what used to be EST,
and now are the Forum Seminars, which incidentally are big in Australia, or at least they were a couple of years ago. You know, you can't leave the room for a number of hours, and if you leave the room, you're criticized. Do we get any place by knocking people down? I don't think we do. I think as Christians, I'm more concerned about encouraging people and building them up, realistically, rather than out there knocking them down. We're told in the Scriptures to build up one another and care for one another and to encourage one another. No place do we read, condemn one another, knock down one another, clobber one another, in hopes that you'll grow. What about encouraging astral flight? This is a technique where you kind of imagine yourself, I think, getting out of your body and going someplace else. I'd watch out for those kinds of things. Some of you have read Richard Foster's book on celebration of discipline, an excellent book, and yet he encourages something which is awfully close to this. And he's been criticized for that one aspect of his book just because of that kind of thing. I'd be very cautious of some of these New Age approaches. Here's another one. Do you consider deep breathing and relaxation techniques, if used carefully, that is, not moving into suggested hypnotic techniques, can this be a useful technique? I have no problem with that. I think sometimes if you can learn to breathe more deeply and to slow down your pace, I think that can be helpful. That's just a physiological way to slow down the body so you can think more carefully. Learning to relax can be very helpful because a lot of us don't know how to relax. But I think this person is concerned about extremes of this. Here again, we need balance. Do you think that guided meditation, that is gaining peace through imagery of Psalm 23, for example, can be useful for people? This gets awfully close, it seems to me, to some of the healing of memory stuff. You know, I'm not opposed to some of that, but I just be cautious. If you can recognize that Christ is with us all the time, that's true. That's good. But I think some of the people that Dave Honey is concerned about in his book said, you sort of assume you're going to somehow bring Christ up, you know, like the witch at Endor was supposed to be trying to do with Samuel. And that sort of thing you've got to be awfully careful about. And sometimes there's a thin line between some of these New Age approaches and between, there's a thin line between some of these approaches that are okay and things that are not okay. A thin line between what is not a cult and what is a cult. I generally work on the assumption that if in doubt, don't. Because I think that's probably a safe approach. The person also mentions a little bit about hypnosis here. That's a hot one. I know some people who are very much involved in use of hypnosis. In this book I edited, one man wrote a chapter on helping people through hypnosis, and I know this guy is a committed evangelical Christian. Other Christians have some real hesitations about hypnosis. And in my newsletter, I tackled it about 3 or 4 issues ago and suggested this very thing. I'm nervous enough about it. And Freud made the statement, Freud thought he didn't need it. He said, I think you can have accomplished without hypnosis most if not all of what you can accomplish with hypnosis. So I would not use it. I have not used it. And I'm skeptical of it. But if somebody is trained in the area, is a committed Christian, and we see this in their life and in their walk, and it seems to know what they're doing, okay, maybe it's okay there. I'm just cautious. Is that an evasive answer? At least it lets you know where I am, even if it's evasive. In secular counseling, there's a lot of emphasis on facing hurts from the past through talking, breathing techniques, etc. How much value is there in dealing with these hurts through facing them compared to inner healing and prayer in addition or the place of just talking? Okay, many of us grow up wounded. Many of the approaches that we bring to adulthood, many of the problems we bring to adulthood come from our past. And for years we've known that it's good to go back and talk about those things. Now, I think sometimes we can overdo it. We spend so much time in the past, we forget about the present. And I'm not sure it's bad to be discussing healing of memories. Some of the books that are written on this, however, I have some discomforts about because I just don't think the authors are really aware of just how dangerous they are in dabbling in some of these things and stirring up a lot of problems that can create problems today, problems that maybe need to be dealt with, but you stir them up and then you don't know how to deal with them. If you are interested in the healing of memories, and please don't reject me because I haven't mentioned your favorite author, because there are a number of authors out there. I think the best writer in this area is David Seamans, S-E-A-M-A-N-D-S. I know David quite well. David teaches at a Methodist seminary. He's been a pastor for a number of years. He's been teaching pastoral care and pastoral counseling. But he brings a very balanced perspective on this. He brings a very good biblical perspective on this. And I think he's, I'm not suggesting that other people are not competent here, but I think David Siemens is perhaps the best one to follow. Pardon? Oh, the name of the book. Well, the book is by David Siemens. The Healing of Memories. Did I write the foreword to that book? The Healing of Memories and Healing Damaged Emotions. And Healing what? And Healing Grace. There we go. Healing Grace, Healing Damaged Emotions, and the Healing of Memories. One of those I wrote a foreword to, I think. I can't remember which one. Putting Away Childish Things. He's got more than one more, but that's another one. His newest one is out, and I forget the title of it. His book of the... Pardon? No, that's not the new... Read it. That one came out about 2 years ago. His newest one came out just before Christmas, and I talked to him a little bit about it. It's got a blue cover, and this one, he talks a lot about forgiveness. And I said to David, I said, I think the best part of your book is your statement on forgiveness in there. It's excellent. It's very well done. You have used the word integrate. Clearly you differ from Jay Adams. How does he use the term integrate or integration? Jay Adams maintains that we can't integrate Christianity with psychology, and we shouldn't try to do it. And if we're trying to do it, we're trying to do the impossible. Some of you maybe have heard the story where a couple of years ago we presented Jay Adams with an award at the Congress on Christian Counseling in Atlanta. I was the man who presented the award to him. I didn't tell you this story, did I? I presented the award to him, and we gave him a beautiful desk set. We gave him a nice plaque. He was one of five people who got the awards, and each of the other four people got up and made some nice comments, and Jay Adams got up, and he tore us to shreds. I think he'd agree with that terminology. He said, you people in Christian counseling, especially you people who are psychologists and psychiatrists, you better get out of that field because you're not serving the Lord effectively if you're there. You're uninformed people. You're trying to integrate. You can't do that. And it was, I think insensitive would be an appropriate word, because we were all people who were having that perspective. And I wasn't sure what I was going to say because I was chairing the meeting. I presented the award. It's not my point to get up and challenge the man who just spoke. And he even quoted one of my books negatively. So I got up and I said, I appreciate Jay Adams' honesty, and I do. And I appreciate his courage, and I do. And he's made a contribution, I believe that. But I said, what is exciting about his response to that? I said, did you hear it? Jay Adams is finally reading Gary Collins' books. And that's all I said. But even Jay laughed. Well, but he doesn't believe in integration, doesn't think it could be done. You suggest a given problem taken to a psychologist would be handled in one way by the secular psychologist and another way by the Christian psychologist. Purely each has results. So how do you evaluate the respective results and outcome? Should there be a clear contrast? Good question. Yes, they both have results. We've studied, and I'm not going to say that the secular counselor is not being effective, because many of them are being effective. I believe that. And some of the problems they deal with, they can be as effective as a Christian counselor can be. Especially problems like dealing with skills and study skills and learning interpersonal relations and those kinds of things. Of course, the secular counselors can be very helpful on those kinds of things. And it's very difficult to evaluate compare their results as contrasted to the Christian counselor's results. Everett Worthington, who wrote a great basic article several years ago on religious counseling, went through every journal he could find on religious counseling for the last 10 years and synthesized the whole thing together in a massive article. He said, when you start looking at the research that has been done, you won't like this, there's no difference between what we find out in the results of Christian counselors and secular counselors, which is interesting. However, I think the Christian counselor can deal with some things that the secular counselor really doesn't understand. And can't, because the natural man understandeth not the things of the Spirit, because they're foolishness unto him. And sometimes we are going to be dealing with things the Christian counselor does not, the secular counselor does not know how to touch. But certainly, many counselors, Christian and secular, can be useful and can come up with some useful conclusions. When people appear and claim to be filled by what they found in Eastern and New Age religions, how can you dialogue with them?
especially when they're not interested in the truth, such as Christianity? Good question. And here again, with difficulty. And maybe you can't get very far. Sometimes you can, because when people argue from their own experience, it's very difficult to deal with those people. And when you find somebody who comes along and say, "Don't confuse me with facts, I've got my own experience." Incidentally, that applies to us too. And you come to somebody and say, "Well, don't confuse me, don't ask me questions about Christianity. I know Jesus lives and He's in me, and therefore I'm not interested in discussing things factually." See, I think we have to have some support for what we're doing. We have to have some understanding of what we believe and why. Our apologetics is as important as our experience. When we argue from experience, then it's one person's experience against another. And that experience is important. I don't deny that. But I think then we need to look and say, well, let's look at some of the things you believe in as a New Age person. What is the basis for what you believe? When I wrote a book several years ago called The Rebuilding of Psychology, I said, let's take the example of the fact that God exists. What's the basis for that? We can't prove it to 100%. But look at the evidence in favor of God's existence versus the evidence in opposition to God's existence. And I think you'll begin to see the evidence in favor of God's existence is greater, even though we can't prove it 100%. So I think there's a place for experience, but there's a place, if you're going to deal with somebody on New Age issues, you need to understand what New Age people think, you need to learn some of their language, you need to read books by Grotius and others so you can deal with them. And I think then you can start talking on a more intellectual basis. But if you're just going on their experiences, you're not going to get very far. Now, with some of these people, they don't want to debate the issue. Their mind is already made up. And maybe we're that way too sometimes. But it's very difficult then. And you maybe have to say, well, I can't get any further with you. I'll continue to pray for you, which incidentally will make a great deal of influence. And maybe at some later time you're able to come back and talk to that person. Well, how am I doing? I've got about 6 done, right? 40-something to go. Yeah, all right. In this morning's diagram, I don't know what morning we wrote this, so it's going to be interesting to see what morning's diagram. You stated that the aim to get the person being helped is to a stage where they no longer require counseling, but a friendly relationship can continue. How do you extract yourself from a situation where the person will not or cannot, due to a psychiatric disorder, listen to advice, and is totally dependent on your visits, especially when you feel obligated to continue, knowing that it's futile? This is why it's much easier to be in some field other than counseling and people helping. Because there are some people who are going to hang on forever. In the church, I think there are pastors. I don't know about the churches here, but do you have some people who are leeches? You don't have to nod your head. They're there all the time. And you try to work with them and they never seem to get better. They are basically dependent people. And as hard as you work on them, they still are basically dependent people. Now, what do you do? Well, you can't kick them out. You might suggest they try another church down the street. But if you do that, the guy down the street will send you his leech back to you, so you got to be careful on that. Incidentally, some of these people do a lot of that church hopping, too, I've noticed. After they get tired of you, they go on to the next congregation, and you breathe a sigh of relief, but there's always some around. Now, I think all you can do is put limits on these people. You can limit, you can say, look, please don't call me at this time, or if they call, say, boy, I appreciate your call, I know it's difficult, let's talk about it tomorrow morning. And that can be it sounds better to say that here than to do it. But sometimes you need to put some limits. Sometimes you maybe have to take your phone off the hook. Sometimes you just have to somehow you've got to limit them, because otherwise they will completely dominate you and take your time. Maybe you need somebody else to help limit you. Because sometimes I can't always limit myself, so I have other people run interference for me. That's a good question with a hard issue to deal with. When are a couple considered to be married? Two people living in de facto come to church and are generally considered to be married to the awarenesses of people, and you treat them as such, and then it's found out that they're not legally married. The church may tend to reject them. This is sad. How do we make members of the congregation aware of this? I consider the union to be improper before legalization, as it is a state requirement and the church tradition.
Now, this is a good question, because some people say, well, we're married, we live together, we are engaged in sex together, we share our budgets together and all that. We're married, we just haven't gone through the formalization of a ceremony. And yet, legally, you should do that. But they can make a very good case, and they can say, well, look in the Old Testament. Did they go through a ceremony in the Old Testament? Well, yes, that's true. Maybe they didn't. But I think here again, they were legally before God. Before God's eyes, they were people who were married. Now, I would suspect if you had a couple like that in your church, I would encourage them and say, look, legal before God, until you've come to that kind of time or that ceremony, seems to me, and before the law, it seems to me that you are not legally married. But if everybody thinks you're married, maybe it's not the place to make a big issue out of it and say, this, we want you to tell you that this man who's been in our church, he and his wife have been in our church for the last 25 years, they've been living in sin all this time, and we want you to know about that. I'm not sure that needs to be said. I think I would be more inclined to have a quiet wedding. I don't know if that's I might get in trouble for that kind of suggestion, but I wonder if you need to make a big issue of this kind of thing. But I think I would encourage these people. Basically, if you look in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, talks about the fact that when a couple engages, and the end of chapter 6, I think, when a couple engages into sexual relationships, in God's eyes, the two have become one. Well, that creates all kinds of havoc in our society when there is so much open sexual behavior and so much confusion. I am convinced that when a couple has that legal commitment, that there's a change in their way of thinking, there's a change in their way of viewing themselves, and a change in the way of viewing their relationship. And I suspect at that point, they're going to feel better about it. And it's a difficult question about a specific problem, but I think depending on where they are, I'd encourage them to get married. How public you make it would have to depend on the situation. You mentioned Ephesians 5:21, mutual submission. Would you expand on this and explain how you understand that to work in family life? Sometimes I get concerned about the fact that husbands come along and say to their wives, okay, your job is to submit to me, so I'm going to sort of crack the whip and be the boss. I don't think that's what the scriptures are talking about. In fact, when it talks about wives submitting to their husbands, it says, as Christ loved the church and gave himself for the church, that's your job as a husband. You've got to be loving and you've got to be giving. Before Julie and I got married, we talked about this. And Julie said, I don't have any problem submitting my husband if my husband is loving, seeks to be loving like Christ loved the church, and is in a giving relationship. Now, it seems to me that in both sides, if we are both loving and caring for the spouse, and both willing to give to the spouse, and both willing to be concerned about the spouse, and to listen to what the spouse has to say, especially when the spouse challenges us, then I think that's a mutual submission. I should probably let Julie speak for herself, but she would probably say that if we reached an impasse in our marriage and it was her opinion against mine, she'd say, okay, Gary, I'll let you have the final say. But I don't know that we've ever got to that point in almost 27 years of marriage, because if we had a difference of opinion, we'll work it through and talk it through and wait until we both pretty much agree on the way that we ought to go. And I think that shows a mutual respect for one another. And that I think is better than one person trying to crack the whip. I especially dislike it when one person uses that to kind of browbeat the other person and maintain some kind of a superiority, which is a smug superiority and an unkind and an unfair superiority. Dr. Stephen Alford says that the more we give our people from the pulpit, the less we will need to counsel them in the pews. In this context, would you agree or disagree with the role of expository preaching as helping to eliminate many of the counseling situations and problems which tend to stifle the growth of many Christians? I am convinced that expository preaching, seems to me it's not done very often much anymore, but I'm convinced that it can be very helpful and very useful and very relevant to people. I agree with that. I don't know that I agree with his statement from Dr. Alford, however. And he, of course, is what? He's one of the princes of the preachers. Because I think sometimes if you're really preaching about things that hit people, that's going to stir them up, and they want to come and talk about it. Secondly, I think this statement assumes that if you give them instruction, that they can therefore accept the instruction, imply it, and solve their own problems. A lot of times people are too disturbed, too distressed, too churned up to be able to do that. And they can't even hear what you're saying, even if it's stated well, with the beautiful ways that Stephen Alford states it. And they can't always get past some of their own obstacles and their own frustrations and their own misunderstandings. We also remember that people sometimes misunderstand what we say in a public meeting. Have you ever had that happen? We had a conference several years ago. It was at Schuller's Church, of all places, before the Crystal Cathedral was built. I was only invited to go there once. I don't know why they didn't ask me back. Anyhow, yes, I think I do know why they didn't ask me back. I said something about positive image at one point, and I maybe didn't quite use the right terms. But anyhow, I was talking about it was a conference on singleness. It was, we had a good conference. Good people, good time there, good time. And I was talking about some of the stresses of the single lifestyle. And along the way, I just happened to mention sex as part of my whole talk. It was a minor part of the talk. But it was a large group there. There were 1,500 people at the conference, as I recall. And the next morning, we were having breakfast in the hotel. And a lady was, you know, everybody in the hotel was from the conference because we'd used up all the hotels all around the area. And I was having breakfast with somebody. And a lady came up and she said, "Hey, did any of you guys hear that speaker last night?" She said, "I was sitting at the back. I couldn't see him very well, but I thought, thank the Lord for that. But did any of you hear him?" I said, "Yeah, I heard him." She says, "Wasn't he awful?" I said, "Well, I've heard worse, but I didn't think he was that bad. Well, what did he say?" And she said, "Well, that part about saying that if you're single, it's okay to have sex with anybody that you want." I said, "Oh, I don't think he said that." Well, she said, "No, I know he said that." And she said, I'm an Episcopalian, and the rector of my church would not go along with that, and I'm leaving the conference today, and I'm going home." And I said, "Wait a minute, wait. Why don't you talk to the organizers of the conference? Talk to somebody else. See if he really said that last night, because I'm sure he didn't say that." Whereupon, I asked the next 15 people that I saw, "What did I say last night?" But she had twisted something. Maybe she'd misheard something. You see, and that is very easy for any of us to do, but it is especially easy to do if you're struggling with an issue or concerned about a problem, and somebody may give a good, concise statement about it, and you miss something, or you twist something, or you get something wrong. So therefore, in the preaching, it may be you need clarification after that. In no way, however, do I put down preaching, because I think that's the public people helping that we talked about. And that, I think, is crucial, and that's important that we have that, we do that public people helping. Considering the potential of one who has suffered a nervous breakdown, is it possible or even acceptable that they could get into the counselor's chair? Realizing, of course, that they need to be able to ward off any pressures that can be brought upon a counselor. This person is saying, okay, if you've had problems yourself, should you ever become a counselor? I think if you've had problems yourself, you've worked them through, you are functioning fine now, then I think, why not become a counselor? Sometimes you can have a greater empathy and a greater understanding, but you also have a greater awareness of the dangers. And if you've got somebody that you can continue to talk to, somebody who can help you when you tend to get burned out, to me, I can see no reason why we can't go in that direction. If we say that a person who's had problems should not become a counselor, and there are some dangers here, so you need to watch that out. Be careful for that. But if we set up stipulations that you can only counsel when you haven't had any problems, then we're not going to have any counselors left, are we? So I think here's a place where you need to be alert, and this person seems to be alert, that pressures can be intense, I can get into difficulties again. Okay, with that awareness, then I think you can be free to go ahead and do some counseling, but I just be careful. What are your views on two people counseling together, such as a husband and wife team? We have found that in years gone by, we always refer people who came to us to professionals, and in every case, it never works. So we have bitten the bullet and do our best with them now, but we do it as a team. Well, I think you recognize that a lot of counseling now is done as teams. See, when I drew that little picture on the board this morning of the counselor and the counselee, well, I assumed it was one counselor and one counselee. But sometimes it's very helpful for a couple to work together. Now, there's a danger in couples working together. And most people that I know who do couple therapy have acknowledged that danger. Because sometimes the problems that the person is bringing up, they trigger problems in your own marriage. So therefore, it's very important that you have a good relationship, and it's probably very important that you are able to talk about yourself with somebody else. Because that can be a threat to your marriage if you're dealing with other people's problems along the way.
also, but if you're dealing with a couple, that can be very helpful to the couple, because suppose you are a male counselor and a couple comes in, it's easy for the wife to feel ganged up on. Or if you are a female couple, if you're a female, I'm getting tired. I guess I am getting tired. If you are a female counselor and a couple comes in, see, it's easy for the man to feel I'm being left out. So sometimes if you have a husband and wife, counseling a husband and wife, that can be helpful. As you know, there's a lot of emphasis now on what we call systems counseling. It suggests that problems don't appear alone. Problems appear in a system. And if you take one person out of that family and counsel that person, and then send that person back into the family, all of those influences in the past will take away what you've done in counseling. So if you can get the husband and wife out together, that's better. Sometimes you bring the whole family out, and that can be better. And if you've got a kid who's a delinquent, it's okay to work with the kid, but if you can work with his mother and father and other members of the family, that can help too. And you discover sometimes when you see the family, now I know why the kid's delinquent. And we're dealing with the wrong person here. And the real person ought to be somebody else. And sometimes you'll have a person come in who's struggling. I can't get along with my husband. When you see the husband, you understand why. And sometimes the client in front of you is not the person who's the real source of the problem. So if you can bring more people in sometimes, it's hard, but it can be done. And very often that's going to work better when you have a husband-wife working together. There are dangers, but I can see no problem with it. I think it can be useful. I'm concerned that in some lay counseling, lay training, some techniques and tools are being demonstrated or just picked up along the way that can be potentially dangerous in unskilled hands. Things like psychodrama, sculpturing, you know, people get up in the room and go to different parts of the room and do certain things. Can you comment on parameters for lay training and the dangers? There's a lot of things that are being developed in the counseling field. Some of those things are of questionable validity. Some of those things are things that are used by people who've had a lot of experience and a lot of training. And things like psychodrama, things like sculpting, things like the use of hypnosis, for example, even systems therapy, where you bring together the whole family. It's not easy to do those kinds of things. And usually people don't do those unless they have had considerable in-depth training. So if a person reads about this and then starts trying it, they could get into some difficulties. It's hard for me. These most recent questions, I haven't seen them until right now. I'm going off the top of my head. I haven't had time to think about the answers. But I think I'd be very cautious of some of these new techniques when you don't have training. At least have some professional or somebody who's got more experience. It doesn't have to be a professional. Somebody with more experience to kind of back you up, so that you don't get yourself into situations where you stir up a lot of difficulties and then are not quite sure what to do with it. I suggest that you stick with the more traditional approaches before you start trying some of these creative and innovative approaches. And once you master the basics, then maybe with some kinds of support along the way, you can try some of these more unusual ones. I'm not saying they shouldn't be used, but I'd be cautious. I, for example, have had no training in psychodrama, no training in sculpting or sculpturing, no training in hypnosis, and I would not think of using any of those because I haven't had training in those things, even though I've read about them and know something of the literature on those things. So I'd just be cautious about that. Oh. Put that one aside. Can you please comment on any difficulties which may arise between those involved in a counseling ministry and those in a deliverance ministry? Well, I guess we'll go back to it. Okay. We're raising some questions here about gifts, about some of those issues. Okay, what about counseling? What about deliverance? I think there is a place at times for recognizing that sometimes we have to be concerned about the demonic. Because I think sometimes people the problem is basically demonic, and you're not going to get very far with your medical counseling, or you're not going to get very far with your psychological counseling or any other kind of counseling. And sometimes you need to be concerned about dealing with the demonic. What bothers me in this are the extremes. The people who think that every problem is demonic and we're going to have a deliverance. And that doesn't happen.
What happens is you have the deliverance service. People get all fired up emotionally and the adrenaline starts pumping. They're fine. Until a few days later when all the old problems come back, the problems that have been there for a long time, and then you have another deliverance and it keeps on going for a long time. And that can happen. Also, what if a person has a biologically based depression? And so you decide you're going to deal with this by a deliverance ministry. And the biological malfunction is still there. But you say to the person, we're going to drive out these demons and you'll be okay. So you have this deliverance service. You drive out the demons. At least that's what you're doing. And the problem comes back. Now the person's not only got the depression, they've got tremendous guilt because they've allowed the demons to come back. And the problem is made worse. I also am concerned when I read about this, the people who write about some of this stuff, and they talk about what they know about demons because of what the demons have told them. Does that bother you? Because you see, the scriptures tell us that the devil is the father of lies. So I wouldn't believe anything that a demon tells me. And yet, with a man writes the teaching, he does seminars on demonology based on what demons have told him. And that, in his deliverance type, that concerns me. Now, if you're working with somebody, and you've dealt with them in a variety of ways, and there's been no real apparent improvement, many times you can discern some things that are different. And you know there's something different about this individual, and I suspect there's something demonic. And I think we can sense that. The Holy Spirit helps us to sense that. Maybe some people have a special gift in discerning there. Then I suggest that if you're going to have that kind of a meeting, you don't do it yourself. That you find some other people to be with you, some other leaders in the church, spiritual men and women of God to be with you, some people who can pray while you're having this kind of deliverance type of situation, and that you make it a private thing and not let it become a show. I don't think Jesus made a lot of this stuff shows. Now, obviously, you're getting a reflection of my own personality and my own theology, but I'd be cautious about it. Well, the fact the lady's holding this up to her mouth means she's going to say something.
Yes.
Go.
We do have one more question tonight.
Yes.
And you've now been answering questions for over half an hour because we had picked up some time. So I'm offering you whether or not you'd like to pick up the rest of those tonight when you've had a chance to maybe look at them more thoroughly.
We have got only, thank you, we've only got about, I joked about having 50 questions. We've only got probably 6 or 7 more. One of these I plan to deal with in my talk tonight. In light of today's increasing homosexuality practice, is the church or Christian counselor to advise or discourage the practice of two people of the opposite sex to share a flat? we'll talk about homosexuality tonight. The fact that two people of the same sex share a flat doesn't mean anything. Some people may raise some questions, but it's the people who are raising the questions that have got the problem as far as I'm concerned. But we'll deal with the whole homosexuality question tonight. I think it's a good idea. I've got 5, maybe 6 or 7 more. I think I can deal with those relatively briefly. And I think that this way we'll get the questions all dealt with. And we'll cover them as we go. I think it's obviously very warm. I don't think that. I know that. It's 22 minutes after. Maybe we need to stop a little bit early and take our break. And I think I can easily handle them.
I've got 3 minutes of that. So you can have the rest, okay? I'll do a deal.
What did I agree to? So if you say it, it's right. 5 minutes what? I've got 5 minutes even now. She changed her mind. I got 5 minutes, she says. Okay, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll do one question, okay? I haven't read these questions. I don't know which one.
Salvation Army will call it for it. There's a question. I see that card. I knew that was one of us. How do you help your church to cope with someone from their ministry? Or mental disorder, a breakdown, a bipolar depression, that kind of thing. Okay, would you like to pick up? All right. Here again,
goes back to the question, doesn't it, about mental illness. And there are, look, let's recognize we have depressed people in the church. We know that. We all get depressed at times. But here is somebody who has a severe depression. I think these people need support. They need to know they're accepted. They don't need to be told if you had a right relationship with the Lord, the depression would go away, because that just makes the situation worse. We need to treat those people, I suggest, like I treat somebody who has a heart condition. I say to that person, get some good medical treatment, because this sounds like something which is physiological. Get some good professional treatment. And we'll pray for you. We'll uphold your family. We'll encourage you. When you get down, we'll stick with you. And we'll try and support your family along the way. And I think if we can do that, we're going to see a greater love and a greater sensitivity appearing in the church. And that's what we're all about, isn't it?